in the ancient Middle East, water was basically a zero-sum game.
Oh, absolutely.
Right. Like if you planted a tree in a drought-prone environment and it failed to produce food, it wasn't just, sitting there taking up space. It was actively killing the crops around it.
Yeah, every drop of moisture it absorbed was a drop stolen from something else.
Exactly. And today we are looking at one of the shortest, seemingly simplest stories in history, but one that carries literal life or death stakes. We are diving into the parable of the barren fig tree, which is found in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 13.
It is remarkably brief, too. I mean, it's a handful of sentences you can read in under 30 seconds.
Yeah.
But beneath that brevity is this really tense narrative about agriculture, economics, and ultimately human hypocrisy. When you look at this text from a Christian perspective, it stops being this like polite farming anecdote and becomes a very uncomfortable mirror held up to our own internal lives.
Okay, let's unpack this because our goal today is to look right past the sanitized modern English translations. We want to dig into the ancient agricultural logistics, the visceral original Greek phrasing, and, well, psychological weight of this text.
Which is heavy.
It really is. It's a text that directly addresses the messy, often frustrating reality of our daily struggles with obedience to God. And the setup for this parable immediately presents a logistical puzzle. The story begins with a man who has a fig tree planted in his vineyard. I'm struggling with the basic premise here.
How so?
Well, if I plant a garden, I keep things separated. Like a fig tree planted in the middle of a grape vineyard sounds like a massive agricultural mistake. Why introduce a competing root system into a space specifically designed for vines?
Yeah, it does sound counterintuitive to us today. I mean, modern agriculture relies heavily on monoculture, right?
Hmm.
Massive, uniform fields of a single crop optimized for machinery. But in first century Judea, interplanting was the strategic standard. A vineyard wasn't just a patch of dirt. It was a highly curated, massive financial investment. The soil was painstakingly cleared of rocks. It was terraced, fertilized.
So they wouldn't just waste the space.
Exactly. Planting a fig tree among the grapevines served incredibly specific symbiotic purposes. The sturdy trunk of the fig tree acted as a natural living trellis for the delicate grapevines to climb.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah, and its broad, dense canopy offered essential shade for the laborers working through that brutal heat of the Levantine summer. Plus, it provided a crucial secondary food crop, like a sort of insurance policy if the grape harvest was poor.
Okay, so that changes the entire dynamic of the story. This tree wasn't some wild, forgotten sapling fighting for survival on the side of a dusty road.
Not at all.
It was highly privileged.
Right. And the theological implication there is profound. In the biblical narrative, the vineyard frequently represents the covenant people of God, Israel, and by extension, the individual believer.
Yeah.
The tree is planted in the absolute best, most fertile soil imaginable. It benefits from every conceivable resource: the law, the prophets, divine protection, and the spiritual community.
I have to challenge this, though, because if we are looking at this as an allegory for human obedience, doesn't the gardener bear the responsibility for a bad crop?
Well,
Like, think about it. If my tomatoes don't grow, I blame the acidity of my soil, or the amount of sunlight, or my watering schedule. I blame my environment. Why is the tree being blamed for its lack of fruit when God is the one who engineered the environment?
that is the exact defense mechanism the parable's designed to dismantle.
Really?
Yeah. When a plant is in poor soil, a lack of fruit is an environmental failure. But when a plant is in meticulously curated, heavily fertilized, protected soil, a lack of fruit is a biological failure. It's an internal breakdown.
Oh, I see.
From a Christian perspective, when an individual has been granted the grace of God, embedded in a faith community, and given access to spiritual truth, a lack of spiritual fruit, things like genuine love, justice, patience, and active obedience, cannot be blamed on the environment. The resources are completely sufficient.
Man, it makes you wonder how often we build up elaborate excuses to avoid the discomfort of actual growth.
Oh, all the time.
It's like having a premium gym membership. You have the world-class trainer, the custom diet plan, the state-of-the-art equipment, all provided for free.
Right.
But we sit on the bench scrolling on our phones, complaining that we aren't getting fit because the gym is too crowded or the music is too loud.
That's a great analogy.
We suffer from massive cognitive dissonance. We know we aren't producing the obedience we are called to. So to soothe that internal tension, we blame the culture, our stressful jobs, or our circumstances. But this text strips all of that away. If you are in the vineyard, your barrenness is not a real estate problem.
And the owner of the vineyard operates on that exact logic. He knows the soil is perfect, so when he comes looking for fruit and finds none, his response is severe.
Yeah, he tells the vine dresser to just get rid of it.
He tells him to cut the tree down. And to understand the gravity of his reaction, we really have to look closely at the language. The Greek word he uses to describe what the tree is doing to the soil is katarge.
Katarge. Because most of our English Bibles translate katarge in a very passive way. The owner says something like, why should it use up the ground?
Right.
It sounds like a landlord mildly annoyed by a tenant who is just taking up space.
But katarge is anything but passive. It means to render entirely idle, to make unproductive, to completely drain of power.
Drain of power.
Yes. Think back to the ecology of the Levant. Water is scarce. Grapevines have deep plunging tap roots to find moisture deep underground, but fig trees have incredibly aggressive, sprawling, shallow root networks.
Okay, so they're soaking up everything on the surface.
Exactly. In a drought-prone area, a leafy fig tree intercepts the surface water and nutrients before they can ever reach the vines. It isn't just sitting there. It is an active parasite.
Here's where it gets really interesting. The owner isn't just annoyed by a lack of figs. He is pointing out a deeply destructive hypocrisy.
Yes.
Because the tree has all these big, beautiful green leaves. To anyone walking by, it looks like a perfectly healthy, thriving part of the vineyard.
It looks great on the outside.
Right. But beneath the surface, it is aggressively stealing vital nutrients from the grapevines around it to maintain that leafy facade while producing absolutely nothing of value.
What's fascinating here is how perfectly this maps onto the psychology of religious hypocrisy. When human beings know they lack the internal fruit of genuine obedience to God, the cognitive dissonance is agonizing.
Oh, for sure.
So to mask that reality, we pour all of our energy into growing leaves. We adopt the right vocabulary. We attend the right services. We engage in loud moral posturing. We build a massive canopy of religious aesthetics.
Just to cover up the barrenness.
Exactly. But maintaining that fake canopy requires immense energy. And we draw that energy away from the people around us.
We drain the ecosystem. I mean, it completely reframes how we view our own private struggles with obedience. We like to think that if we are stagnant or harboring some hidden disobedience, it's just a pause on our own personal spiritual journey.
A victimless crime?
The victimless crime, exactly. Yeah. But this ecological reality suggests that a fake, purely aesthetic Christianity actually dehydrates the spiritual community around you. You are actively pulling nutrients out of the soil to sustain an illusion.
Which is why agricultural logic and divine justice demands intervention. A parasitic plant threatening the primary crop just cannot be tolerated. The owner doesn't suggest a light pruning.
No.
The Greek word he uses for cut it down is ekupsin. It literally means to strike out from the root. It is a command for total, permanent, violent extraction.
Strike out from the root. It's an execution.
It is.
If a tree is literally stealing water and threatening the entire vineyard, agricultural logic says you rip it out immediately. So why doesn't he? I mean, we have total destruction on the table, completely justified by the tree's parasitic nature, but the axe doesn't fall.
Right. Well, we step right into the tension between absolute justice and unmerited grace here. And to grasp the scale of that grace, we have to look at the timeline the owner provides.
Okay.
He says he has come seeking fruit for 3 years to no avail. That number isn't arbitrary. Agricultural scholars and early church fathers point back to Levitical law, specifically Leviticus 19.23.
What does the ancient legal code say about planting trees?
It states that when a farmer planted a new fruit tree in the land, the fruit was considered uncircumcised or forbidden for the first 3 years.
Really? For three whole years?
Yep. Culturally and agriculturally, the farmer was required to pinch off the early buds so the tree could establish a robust root system. You couldn't even attempt to harvest it until its fourth year. And even then, that crop was considered holy to the Lord. You couldn't eat it yourself until year five.
Wait, so if the owner has been actively looking for a mature, edible crop for three additional years and finding nothing, this tree is at least 6 or 7 years old.
Precisely. It is chronically, stubbornly barren.
Yeah.
It has exhausted every reasonable timeline for development. And there's a prophetic layer here as well.
Oh, right, with Jesus.
Yeah, the earthly ministry of Jesus lasted approximately 3 years. By delivering this parable near the end of that period, Jesus is offering a thinly veiled, urgent warning to the religious establishment of Judea. He is essentially saying, I have been seeking spiritual fruit from this generation for 3 years. The timeline is exhausted. divine patience is reaching its limit.
Wow. So the legal time is up, the tree is an active parasite, and the owner's command for Ekupson is entirely just.
Yes.
This is the moment the Vinedresser steps between the owner and the tree.
And Vinedresser introduces a profoundly disruptive element. In the theological framework of the text, if the owner represents the righteous justice of God the Father, the Vinedresser represents the interceding mercy of Christ. He begs for the tree's life, asking for just one more year. But notice what he offers to do during that year. He doesn't say he's going to water it more or give it more sunlight. He says he will dig around it and put on manure.
Yeah, let's talk about that specific phrase. Because older translations like the King James say, cast dung, and we read that today and think of, like, buying a neat, sterile bag of fertilizer at the local hardware store.
Right, which isn't it at all.
Not at all. In a first century, honor and shame-based Middle Eastern culture, this is a shocking image.
It is incredibly undignified. The Vinedresser is offering to get down on his hands and knees in the dirt to physically expose the root system of this stubborn parasitic tree and manually pack it with animal feces.
Ugh.
It is foul-smelling, humiliating work. He is willing to endure the indignity of handling waste to secure one final, completely unmerited season of grace for a tree that has done nothing but steal from him.
So what does this all mean for us? I think we often misinterpret what grace actually looks like in practice. We tend to view grace as this sterile legal transaction where God just looks the other way from heaven and stamps our passport.
Oh, absolutely. A very clean transaction.
Yeah, a clean transaction. But this text suggests that grace is deeply intrusive. It requires digging around the roots. And think about what digging does to a tree. It destabilizes it. It exposes the hidden parts to the air.
It is a violent disruption of the status quo.
Right. And when we are trying to be obedient and suddenly our lives feel incredibly chaotic or vulnerable or humiliating, you know, when it feels like everything we've built is being destabilized and our reality is literally covered in manure, we immediately assume God is punishing us. We assume we are under the axe.
Yeah, we think we're being cut down.
But maybe that absolute messiness isn't punishment at all. Maybe that discomfort is actually the Vinedresser doing the dirty work of grace. He is disrupting the comfortable soil of your hypocrisy. He is applying the harsh fertilizer of difficult circumstances because it is the only psychological and spiritual mechanism that will finally shock you into producing genuine fruit.
That reframing really changes how we endure suffering and discipline. It forces us to ask whether the chaos in our lives is actually the painful process of unmerited mercy at work. The Vinedresser is literally getting his hands dirty to save us from ourselves.
Yeah.
And he secures a temporary reprieve. He buys the tree a window of time.
Which leads to the ultimate burning question of the text. After the owner agrees to wait, after the Vinedresser does the humiliating work of packing the roots with manure, does the tree finally produce figs?
Well, if you read it in modern English, you get a very neat conditional conclusion. The Vinedresser says, if it bears fruit next year, well and good. But if not, you can cut it down. It feels like a standard contract. But the original Greek language hits with a completely different psychological weight.
How does the Greek change the ending?
Two critical ways. First, the phrase we translate as next year is "eis to melon." A much more accurate translation is "in the coming time" or "into the future."
Okay, so it's not a rigid 12 months.
Right. It isn't a strict 365-day calendar year. It is a purposefully vague, undetermined window of grace. But the second part is grammatically shocking. The sentence itself is structurally unfinished.
Unfinished, as in the thought just stops.
Literally. If you look at raw, literal translations of the Greek syntax, the Vinedresser says, and if indeed it may bear fruit, and if not so, thereafter thou shalt cut it off.
Wait, and if indeed it may bear fruit, dash.
A dash. Silence. The sentence hangs in midair. Jesus purposely refuses to provide the resolution.
Wow. Leaving the sentence unfinished shifts the entire burden of the story onto the person listening to it.
Yes, exactly.
You aren't just hearing a parable anymore. You're subtly trapped inside it. By refusing to finish the sentence, the text forces the listener to realize that they are the only ones who can write the ending. The easeless to melon, that vague window of coming time, is the very moment the listener is currently living in.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this grammatical suspense is a psychological masterstroke. It creates an agonizing sense of urgency. The Vinedresser's intercession is powerful, but it is not permanent. The grace has an expiration date, and the only thing that completes the Greek sentence is the active, lived repentance of the individual.
But the biblical narrative doesn't actually leave this concept completely unresolved, does it? Because later in the Gospels, a very bizarre, very famous event takes place that serves as a terrifying companion piece to this exact parable.
It does. And it is crucial to distinguish the two, but they are absolutely linked. What we've been discussing in Luke 13 is a spoken parable. But a few chapters later, during Passion Week, the final days before the crucifixion, Jesus enacts a miracle that brings the hanging sentence of Luke 13 to its terrifying conclusion. You find the account in the Gospels of Matthew and Mark.
This is the cursing of the fig tree. Jesus is walking toward Jerusalem. He is hungry, and he sees a literal fig tree in the distance. And the text specifically notes that the tree is in full leaf.
Yes, in full leaf.
It is constructed that massive, beautiful green canopy. It looks like the healthiest thing in the environment. But when Jesus approaches it, he parts the leaves and finds absolutely nothing, no fruit.
It is the exact manifestation of the tree from the parable. All leaves, no fruit. An active parasite drawing resources from the earth to maintain a facade. And you have to look at the context of Passion Week. Jesus is about to enter the temple in Jerusalem and overturn the tables of the money changers. He is confronting a religious establishment that is completely covered in the lush green leaves of ritual, rule-keeping, and public morality, but completely barren of the actual fruits of justice, mercy, and genuine love for God.
And this time, there is no intercession. The vine dresser doesn't step in to ask for another year. There is no offer of manure.
The time of ease to melon has expired. Jesus speaks a curse over the tree, and the text tells us it instantly withers from the roots up. It is the exact literal execution of Ekupson striking out from the root. Jesus was demonstrating in physical time and space what happens when the extended window of grace closes on a life that refuses to produce fruit.
Man, a spoken warning in Luke 13 literally becomes an enacted judgment in Matthew 21. That is a sobering reality, because it means we are currently living in the dash of that unfinished Greek sentence. We are existing inside the ease to melon.
We really are.
The vine dresser is interceding for us right now. He is doing the messy, destabilizing work in our lives, giving us the opportunity to turn our religious aesthetics into genuine obedience. But that time is finite.
It forces a profound internal audit. When you examine your own life through the lens of this agricultural reality, you have to ask yourself what you are actually cultivating. Are you pouring all of your emotional and spiritual energy into growing a leafy facade?
Yeah.
Are you just trying to look like a healthy Christian to your community while secretly draining the life out of the people around you to maintain that image? Or are you willing to let the vine dresser into the messy, uncomfortable, dirty parts of your life? Are you willing to endure the humiliation of the manure so that genuine fruit can finally grow?
That is the defining question of a spiritual life. We spend so much time obsessing over our leaves. We want our faith to look pristine, organized, and impressive to the outside world. But I want to leave you with one final, slightly provocative thought to mull over as you go about your day.
I love provocative thoughts.
We've established the severe danger of a tree that is covered in leaves but has no fruit. The danger of hypocrisy. But what does the inverse look like? What does a tree with heavy, mature fruit but no leaves actually look like?
Oh, wow.
Right. Is it possible that true, deep obedience to God sometimes looks completely unimpressive to the outside world? It might look bare. It might look vulnerable. It might lack the massive religious canopy that everyone else uses to signal their virtue. But maybe the owner of the vineyard isn't looking for pristine foliage at all. Maybe he's just looking for the heavy, messy reality of actual fruit, regardless of how bare the branches look in the process.
That is a brilliant perspective. The aesthetic of growth is entirely secondary to the substance of obedience. Thank you for walking through this ancient soil with us today.
Keep digging into the texts, keep embracing the destabilizing work of grace, and keep asking the hard questions. We'll see you on the next deep dive.